My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I haven't found necessary to take a drink, nor have I had a drink, with the help of God. The help of God. He's everything. Since January 25th, 1981. And I'm grateful for that. I'm 64 years old and self-supporting through my own contributions most of the time. Married 32 years and four children, six grandchildren, and a lot of good stuff going on. So I'm going to talk to you guys about something. I think I'm going to, I don't really plan these things. I was going to give my talk on humility, but the crowd's too small. I think I'm going to talk about my Camaro. Yeah, I think I'll talk about my Camaro. Cars are important, you know. Yeah. Cars and women. Women and cars are important. Well, you need a car in order to get a woman. A woman. Yeah, they're real important. I chased women a lot. I knew there was one here that was going to make me okay. Well, you know, when you're... I've heard that women chase men, you know, so they'll be okay, but I don't know about that because I'm not a woman, so that may not be true. But any red blood American boy knows that if you're gonna get a woman, and you got to have a woman, you know, I mean, what's worse than being without a woman on a Saturday night? You might as well kill yourself, right? You know. So, well, the next best thing to that is a bottle of scotch. But if, you know, if you're going to get a woman, you really got to have a car, don't you think? I mean, a cool car. As a matter of fact, if you're going to get a woman, it helps to be cool. I was never cool, but I was trying. I've tried real hard. Unfortunately, it all wound up in disaster, and I wound up in AA, and after 32 years of AA, I've been, like, de-hipped. It uncooled me, you know. My 27-year-old daughter, who finally told me, she's the last one moving out, she's moving to New York with a boyfriend, she said, "Dad, you are so lame. You're such a lame." I said, "Thank God I made it, you know." I almost died out there being cool. So let me tell you about this Camaro. You know, if you understand about the Camaro, I think you're going to understand about, you might understand a little bit about alcoholism now. In order to see it the way I see it, this is not putting anybody down, it's just, you know, it just has something to do with experience. You know, that's how we mature in this thing, through experiences, and I'll talk a little bit about that. And, you know, that old story I say, that old line that my sponsor told me, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will have walked away with an experience. And, you know, I'll tell you, I've been a lawyer for, what, like 35 years, trying cases and doing that stuff. And I got a lot of people who come up to me with big problems. I mean, lawyers are great, but, you know, experience is no substitute for experience, right? No substitute for knowing the deal, walking through the fire. So when I was... I seem to remember when I was 16 or 17 years old, I had found a copy of Playboy magazine somewhere. And it's possible, based upon what I know about Playboy magazine and its circulation, that I'm not the only guy in the United States that found a copy of that deal. I really don't know why they bothered to put articles in that book. I mean, anybody who actually reads the article should be shot, you know? Or they're liars, you know? And... besides, how can you read an article sideways? You know what I mean? And I took one look at that Playboy magazine, and I knew what would fix me immediately. And because apparently I needed fixing. Now, I didn't realize I needed fixing. You know, you just... because it says in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says our alcoholic thinking seems normal. So whatever... and apparently, and they say this in the big book too, I didn't realize this until I got in here. I didn't know what my problem was until I got in here. As a matter of fact, I didn't really know what my problem was until I was about 20 years sober. But you know, I hung out there until something became clear. It says men and women drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. It says we're restless, irritable, and discontented. which I've determined is not a good way to be. We're restless. You know, alcoholic restless. You ever watch a new guy in Alcoholics Anonymous? If you could tie his feet to a propeller, he'd like float out of the room. You know, you're here, but you know you really should be there, you know. You're in this job, but you really know you should be at that job. You got this guy, but you should have that gal. You're in Miami, but you know you'd be okay if you're in Los Angeles. I mean, it's like you just don't want to stay. You know there's a party going on somewhere, and you're not invited, and then you get invited, and you say, you know, there's a better one going on down the street. And we're restless, irritable, and discontented. No, we're not happy. We're not happy. You know? And unless we can experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And it says, so apparently, the alcoholism is what happens to us when we're sober. Now, I didn't know that. You know, how are you going to know that? Because, you know, when I came in here, I don't know about you, I came in here to stop drinking. I didn't come here to find God or to be well or anything. I came here to stop drinking. So I thought alcohol consumption was the problem. I had finally gotten to the point where alcohol consumption was the problem. And the program is called Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And the disease is called alcoholism, right? So you would excuse me if I thought that maybe my problem had something to do with alcohol. And when they really start, they don't arrest you for driving while fat or driving while, the cop doesn't stop you and say, well, excuse me, sir, I can't. It seemed to me like you were lusting or coveting while you were driving. Or I'm stopping you because are you driving filled with self-pity? You know, I mean, you seem to be obsessing about women or money or sex or stuff like that. So would you please get on the scale or that or whatever? It's about the booze. It's all about the booze. It's the booze, the booze, the booze, you know? As a matter, even after you get sober here, they don't care. I mean, you could be a child rapist, a monster or something like that. You got 5 years, they're giving you a medallion. Hey, keep coming back. Hey. I raped 15 chickens and a banana. Yeah, but you didn't have a drink today, did you? No, hey, you're a success. Yes. What do you mean? You think I'm lying? They don't pay me enough to lie. My memory's not good enough to lie. It just comes out, you know? I mean, I've been around here, you know? So apparently the disease centers in our mind, not our body. You know? So if you're in here and you're an alcoholic and you have a mind, you're in trouble. And I'm looking at you guys, and I don't really think you have much to worry about. No problem here. No, you guys are obviously out cut above. You were like the Mensa of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're like the... I'm talking about the lower class alcoholics, you know? The ones over at my group. So apparently, it centers in our mind. It has something to do with the way we're thinking. And, you know, I didn't really experience alcoholism until after I got sober. You got to be sober for it. The only thing I experienced is something called drunk. You never experience alcoholism because, you know, because we use alcohol. I'm an alcoholic because no woman, no suit of clothes, no car ever worked quite as well as just a few drinks. So I drank it. Alcoholism is something we use to chase away the alcohol. Alcohol is what we use to medicate or chase away the alcoholism. That's why we drink it. You know, if I started feeling restless, if I started feeling irritable, if I started feeling discontented, which is like every other, you know how it is in AA. You know, you're up, you're down, you're up, you're down, you're up, you're down, and then you get to the second hour, you know, and it's... Some guy said, he says, you know, I think you have a split personality. I said, I wish I could get it down to two. I'd be okay. It's like 18 in there, you know. So it's that mind thing, you know. And so when alcohol would even rear its ugly head, you know, 15, 20 miles away, you know, what's going to happen 2 years from now, next 30, you know, I'd say, this is what I'd say, I need a drink. I go whack and it would go away. It goes away for a while. Whack and I'm John Wayne. Whack and I'm Brad Pitt. Whack, I'm anybody I want to be. Whack, I'm okay, you know. Whack, I'm unconscious. Unconscious is okay. You know, Carl Menninger wrote a book called Man Against Himself. It came out a few years before the big book. And he had a chapter on alcoholism that says alcoholics are men and women who are out to destroy themselves. To kill themselves. They hate themselves. I didn't know I hated myself. I thought I loved myself. Well, you know, it's sort of like this strange thing about alcoholism. You know, we're entitled, we're the greatest, we're wonderful. Why doesn't everybody know that? And then there's another part of our brain that says, you are some piece of crap. You should be dead. You're never going to get this thing. You're a jerk. You're a loser. You know, it sets up some sort of friction which can be solved by scotch. I don't know what it is, but it's, we got some, you know, which is it any wonder that we watch these people. You know, we see people and they have all the money and all the fame, all the movie stars and everything like that. Thank God they exist and we watch them explode. It could be Whitney Houston. We watch them, the greatest talents in the world, Britney Spears, they just explode. And you say, man, if I had that money, if I had that deal, I'd be one. And no, you wouldn't. You'd probably be dead faster than they were. Because alcoholics are men and women who have to destroy themselves. They'll use any means, any method, any way to destroy themselves. As a matter of fact, you're lucky if you don't have the money. Because if you have the money, all it allows you to do is keep your arrogant, defiant self going and surround yourself with sycophants, people that don't give a crap about you, that'll tell you you're okay until you die. And you can pull a Michael Jackson or something like that, because nobody can tell you anything because you got the power. You know, the greatest thing that happens to you is if you're broke, you're busted, you're in jail, because then you're forced through humiliation to get some sort of humility and maybe to listen. So, you know, so if you're broke, thank God for that. You know, so thank you, Jesus, you know. I've already misbehaved. I said Jesus. They called me from North Carolina. They wanted me to speak at some convention or something. They said they had listened to some tapes. They said, well, but can you tone it down, you know? And it's, I knew what they were saying. They didn't want me to talk about the Bible or Jesus or anything like that. I said, no, I can't. How can I tell my story or talk about what's going on? How can I do my deal? Like, tone it down. You mean, can I prostitute myself? Well, yeah, I'm good at that, you know. Can I throw away my integrity? Yeah, I've done that before, you know. Can I worry more about my integrity and my relationship with God and just throw that off to the side because I'm more worried about what you think about me? Yeah, I can do that. I've been doing that. Man, I did that for 31 years before I came in here. I was anything you wanted me to be, you know, as long as you'd like me, I'd do anything. I could do that. I could be codependent, you know. But today, I think I'm going to hang on to my integrity just for today, you know, because I think it's tied into my happiness and tied into my sobriety. So the Camaro, I don't want to forget about the Camaro. It'll make the Camaro feel bad. I don't want to hurt the Camaro's feelings. So listen, now most of you guys, a lot of you guys are young. I mean, I'm talking young. I mean, I'll tell you, how many here are under 30 years old? Oh my God. Can you vote when you're 30? No wonder this country is all sucky, you know? And my shoes are older than you are. I'm wearing shoes. So, under 30 years old. I was sober. I was already in AA when these guys were like, you know, paramecium or something. In other words, whatever. So, in any event, so let me tell you a little bit about alcoholism, which really doesn't have much to do with drinking, except, you know, if you don't treat it, that's what you'll do, or blow your brains out. So, one day, I was looking at a Playboy magazine, and I said, I need one of those. And I'm not the only one, by the way, because I drive around and I see these billboards. Yeah, I mean, let me just give you a little hint about something in case you haven't figured it out. The world doesn't want to help you stay sober. The world wants you to drink. Now, the truth is, and I don't make any bones about it, I'm a Christian guy. We believe in things like the devil and Satan and all that sort of satanic stuff, and we believe like Satan runs this world. You don't have to believe that stuff. It's not to be an AA, you don't have to believe that. It's just my stuff, you know. It works for me better to believe that way, because then I understand why they have billboards all over the place wherever I look that tells me you're a piece of crap unless you have this or unless you buy that. You know, that tells women, billboards that tell them unless you get a breast enhancements, you're a piece of crap, you know. That somehow a whole world of TV and movies with commercials where the newscasters look better than I'll be in my entire life. An entire world that is promoting stuff for money and for a million other things, not because they care about me, because somebody wants to make a profit, just to make me feel that somehow, some way, I am deficient to the extreme unless I buy something, get something, lose some weight, do something, because on my own, the way I am, I'm a piece of crap. And by the way, that's the world you live in. That's what you see when you turn on TV. You've gotten so used to it that you don't even recognize when it's happened, you know. At least they're being equal now. It used to be only the women that used to worry about their looks all the time and their vanity and all that sort of stuff and feeling crappy about themselves because they didn't have big enough boobs or because of their hair color or because they were too much they weighed. Now at least they're going after the guys with Viagra, so, you know, and I'm in favor of that. I think you should have a population of men that feel they're a piece of crap and they're worthless unless they keep hard on for 4 hours. I like that deal. I like that deal. Just some more insecure, childish men. That's what we need. We don't have enough of those guys around. I don't know. So, in any event, I'm trying to keep this light. I haven't even got going yet. Where did you hear the second half, you know? So, it'd be funny, isn't it, if it wasn't true? So that's the problem. You see, the problem with stuff like this is it's kind of funny. Then you walk out and you say, you know there's some sort of truth to that. You're not quite sure what. And then all of a sudden you see your first billboard or you turn on your first TV. And you don't realize, you say, man, I've been watching this stuff for years, feeding this stuff. What has it been doing to my mind and telling me about me? So when you're in the shower and you're lathering up, or you're in the car and you're driving, you hear this little voice says, you're a piece of shit. You're one piece of crap. You know that accusatorial voice accusing you of being an idiot or being stupid or people don't liking you or somehow you got that feeling, that sort of paranoia, alcoholic paranoia, that people are always thinking about you because you're always thinking about you, and it's always bad thoughts about you. They're thinking bad thoughts about you, and why aren't they accepting you? And of course, if you're an alcoholic, you're an acceptaholic, and why don't they love me, aholic? And, you know, and you're wondering where all those bad thoughts are coming from. You think you turn around to say who's calling you a piece of crap, and there's nobody in the shower but you, and you realize it's you. It's you talking to you about what you really think you are. And you wonder why, and listen, sure you can stop the drinking, how are you going to stop the thinking, how are you going to stop the voices? You got 2 years, you got 3 years, you got 5 years, you're still talking that crap to yourself, and you don't know how to get rid of it, and you don't even know how to talk about it at meetings because you're embarrassed, because you're ashamed, because you talk about it at meetings, they'll think you're a piece of crap, and you want them to know you're cool, because the last thing you want is somebody to think that you have a problem, which is another deal too, because you worry so much about how you look and who you are and all that stuff, and so why would you ever expect that you're going to be happy, joyous, and free to have that new freedom and that new happiness? Why would you expect to have that when you're not drinking, but you're all boxed up with the alcoholism? And they say in the big book, what does it say? We're experiencing much of heaven. We're going to be rocketing the fourth dimension of existence of which we have not even dreamed. Isn't that what they said? But you guys are going to never get that because you're not doing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's for the people who did the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're not doing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, so you're never going to get that. So if you're worried why you have 10 years and 15 years and 20 years and you still feel like crap, it's because you're not doing it. So that's the sad news, but that's why I don't get a lot of convention speaking, because I'm not a big promoter, in a sense, of AA. It's a wonderful program. I'm a connoisseur of the big book, okay? So in any event, just write New York and say there's some old-timer who's screwing up new people. But so let me get to the point. What time is it? 8? I got another half an hour or so. I can do this. So I got this Camaro. I was reading this Playboy, and they had just come down with the Camaros. This is like 1970. Now, I don't know anything about Camaros now. I haven't looked at Camaros. I don't know what the deal is. But back then, they were like Batmobiles. They were like unbelievable. And they had just come to Miami. It was the first time the fastbacks had come to the Camaro. They were the Camaros and they were the Firebirds. And they looked sort of similar. I knew. You ever know that something will change your life? Well, sure, you're alcoholics. What am I looking at? Oh, if I only lost 30 pounds of child. Oh, if I can only gain more money. Oh, if I only moved to a new house. Oh, if I only have a guy. If only I was an if-onlier and a yes-butter and a you-don't-understander from the word go. You know what I mean? So the bottom line is, so how many times have you said, if only this, if only that, and you know, let me tell you something. I've spent more money I don't have buying things I don't need to impress people I don't like you can possibly imagine. You know? I make good money, and I'm always broke, you know, because I always have to have this, and I have to have this, because I have to have that in order to be okay, because I'm never okay just the way I am like this. You know, I get haircuts when I don't need haircuts, right? Girls, you get your nails done when you don't need your nails done. You get your hair done when you don't need your hair done. You spend all sorts of money on blouses and stuff like that. And guys spend money on holding those, what they spend money on. And it's all bullshit. None of it ever works. Well, it works for about 5 minutes. It's like booze. Don't say it doesn't work. It does work. Because after the booze, there's the other stuff. There's the other stuff that we spend money on that we're addicted to. The other idols that we think we're convinced is going to fix us up, but they never really work, right? Man, there ain't a haircut or hairdo in the world that's going to make you feel like a decent woman. You know, forever. Nothing you can do on the outside is going to fix that deal. You know, there's an inside job. Same thing with the guy. So, in any event, but I didn't know that was alcoholism. Because the truth is, most of the world thinks that way, right? As a matter of fact, if you want to start, don't start talking like me or thinking like me, because if you're a people pleaser, if you want people to like you, because people won't like you, you will get wounded. They'll talk about you behind your back. They'll snicker. They'll say, "Man, that guy's an idiot." You believe that crap, because the world is, it's not that they're not ready for it. They don't want to hear it. They just don't want to hear it. You know, they're drunk on materialism. That's what the seventh step is all about, and the sixth step. You know, this is a book that tells you to focus everything, makes God the centerpiece of your life. And we live in a world, and we have a mind that tells us if we only have things, we'll be okay. They don't want to hear about God. They want to hear about the things. They want this to be all psychological and intellectual and stuff like that. They don't want to hear about a guy like me talking against cars and everything like that, because that's all you think about. The stuff I'm talking against is the stuff you think about. That's what you think about all the time. That's not the centerpiece in your life. Your centerpiece of your life is your job and the money and the girl and the wife, you know, all this sort of crap. So let me get back to this Camaro thing. So I decided that I needed to have this Camaro. I had inherited a little money, about $6,000 or $7,000. Back then, a car cost about $6,000 or $7,000, and I knew if I had this Camaro, I would be okay. I went down to Patapkin Chevrolet. It was on, I think it was on my Miami Beach. I think it was Patapkin. You know, it was, you know, we're talking 71. How many years ago is that? A long time. Thanks, honey. I appreciate that. It was a long time ago. It was 42 years? Wow. So, 42 years ago, I go down to Tampton Chevrolet, and I pay off the car, the Camaro. It was gold, metallic gold, with a white Landau top. Now, Landau tops, I know they're kind of cheesy. I'm not even sure people even know under 30 what a Landau top is, you know? That's like talking to them about LP records or something, you know? I don't even know what that is. But a Landau top, it was like a white vinyl top, you know what I mean? And a gold outside, and it was like gold or greenish on the inside, and it was like unbelievable. And I landed on the money, I went to take the car, it was Friday, and the guy says, and I'm as sober as I am right now, I mean physically, and he says, but I had that ism pumping through me, you know, and he says to me, I can't let you have it, it has to be prepped. It was on the showroom floor. This was the car on the showroom floor, the first one in Miami. He says it has to be prepped. Now imagine, you know your life is a piece of crap. You know you're nobody, you're nothing. I mean, that was my real problem. I was a nothing. I was always going to be a nothing. You know, and I threw some stuff in my body. And for a nanosecond, I became an almost. When you're nothing, almost is top of the world, you know. So here's this car that's going to make me everything. It's going to make me everything. I'm going to be everything when I get this car. And he's telling me I can't have it until tomorrow. And I say, and I had paid $400 for the prep. He says, no. He says, you can't have it. It's the law. We got to prep it. But if you come here tomorrow morning, we'll have the car for you. So like at 8:30 in the morning, I'm camping out there waiting for the car. This is a true story. Who can make this stuff up? I don't know how old I am, 18, 19, 20, you know, I'm going to the University of Miami, and I finally, they released the car to me. It has a couple hundred miles on it, or 100 miles, whatever new car has. I get in that car, and I get on Alton Road. It's like 10 o'clock in the morning. There's like nobody on the street. It's like a Saturday morning. There's nobody on the street. It's early in the morning, like 9 o'clock, 9:30. And I'm driving down the street, and I swear, I'm in this car, this brand new car. Anybody ever drive a brand new car off the lot? I thought the entire planet Earth was looking at me. They hadn't even invented Google Earth at that time. I thought every woman in China, look at that man and that. I thought they were all, I was down the street, you know, with my hand out with the window on the door, you know, this, just driving slow so they could see me in the car, you know. And sure, you're laughing, you don't know what it's like, you know. I stop at a light. My troubles are over. Over. I stop at a light. Playboy bunnies, here I come. I stop at a light. Guy pulls up next to me. An old guy. A guy who's like, he's over the hill. He might as well be dead, you know? My age, you know what I mean? Isn't that how sad the way life works? The guys that don't need the cars, because they're never going to get it, forget it. You know what I mean? They're the ones that get the cars. He pulls up right next to me to my right in a brand new Cadillac. What's even worse? He's got this gorgeous blonde, this Playboy bunny sitting next to him. I had the car, but he had the better car and the money. You know what I mean? But I'm sitting there, and I look at him, and he looks at me, looks down at me, because I'm. I look at him, and he looks at me. I look at him, and he looks at me, and a thought goes across my mind: why can't I have a car like that? Why can't I have a girl like that? The feeling lasted two blocks. The payments lasted 36 months. 36 months of driving around the car that I knew wasn't good enough. Where there were guys with better cars. You know, that feeling of buying that new car and getting that new thing kept me coming back and coming back and bankrupting myself. That's the deal. When you're an alcoholic, here's what happens. The car gets scratched. Nobody sees it, but you see it. It's scratched. It's like an old car now. It's going to cost $500 to fix the scratch. You only have $500 in your bank account. What are you going to do? You need to buy food. Well, you fix the scratch. Because the car is a reflection of who you really are. And you spend money on stupid stuff because you're worried about what people will think about you. As you're saying to other people, I don't give a crap what other people think about me. But all you do is think about what people think about you, because people who don't think about what other people think about them don't say, I don't care what people think about me. They say things like, pass the salt, but they don't say that stuff. So you know that feeling, if you've ever had that feeling, I've got to have this. I need to have that. Or why don't I have that? Well, what if I lose that? Or when am I going to get that? Let me tell you what that is. You ready for what that is? That's called alcoholism. Have you gotten rid of that feeling completely? It's a problem, isn't it? You're never going to experience it. You're never going to experience the rocket ship ride unless you can get rid of that feeling. So you think alcoholism is the drinking. The drinking is what you do because you have that feeling. Because you need that stuff. Because you're going to lose that stuff. You're going to lose that thing. You're not going to have that stuff. You just can't get rid of that stuff. You know why? I'll tell you why. It's all because it's all about you. See, that's what you say. You say things. This is what you say in your mind. There's a little voice there. And all it says, 24/7, it says this: but what about me? That's all it says, but what about me? You know, if we were to slice you open at any second, there'd be that little voice in there saying, but what about me? What about me? But what about me? So I took that Camaro and I got myself a girl. The love of my life, you know. If you're an alcoholic, you're a stalker, you know what I mean? I stalked out my prey, I got her. The love of my life, you know. Lynn from Totowa, New Jersey. Her parents had sent her down here and were paying, from middle class family, paying for her to go to the University of Miami. And so she was down here the whole time, and it was that true alky love, you know what I mean? Alky love. Every single second of the day, I had to be with her or thinking about her or talking to her. Thank God they didn't have texts, you know what I mean? I'd be on a 5-mile pileup or something like that, you know? And, you know, it's a, where is she? What is she doing? You know, fantasizing about her and where we're going to be and little Russells and married and all this sort of alcoholic, romantic, you know, me, 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 you know? So one day she says to me this. I remember taking, I wish I could find that picture. I know it's around somewhere. One of these days, maybe I told her one time, we drove down to the Keys, and I said, here's the camera. Take a picture of me in the Camaro. I stood next to the Camaro. I said, snap, and I had this picture of me holding on, hugging the Camaro. That's, I wish I had that picture. I'd blow it up, I'd put it right here. It's, Hey, that's the problem. Things were going great for me before they... What happened to that Camaro, you know? So she says to me one day, get this. Her parents, who had been paying for her down here, said this. Said, we would like you to come up to be with us for Christmas. Christmas, a very romantic, very important holiday. They felt after a year they wanted their little girl who they had to be with them. I assume, since being a father and I have three daughters now, that's probably what they wanted. And she said to me, we were having a nice time, dinner or something, and she said, this is what she said, my parents want me to come up there. I'm going to go up there to be with my parents on Christmas. And a feeling welled up in me of unbelievable rage. And this is what I said. I said, what about me? You think it's funny? You don't know what that's like. It's a terrible... You do? Oh. At least one person identifies with me. You know what I mean? What about me? No, I mean, I'm serious. What about me? I'm serious. What about me? What am I supposed to do? I'm supposed to be here? Well, of course, after I got my ticket and flew up there and stalked her, you know what I mean? What about me? What about me? It's all about me. What's going to happen to me? Why do I feel this way? You know, one day I got married to a beautiful gal. Sweet gal. Nice gal, non-alcoholic. You know, I graduated law school, got a job. We had a child, beautiful house on Miami Beach, right on LaGorse Country Club, the golf course. Had everything. They had beautiful parents, beautiful in-laws, wonderful, decent people with integrity. And I was married for 3, 4, 5 years, and I started going to the bars. I started looking at those gals. And you know what? I started feeling a little I was restless. You know, I mean, you know, I had a beautiful wife, I had a nice house, I had a nice, but you know, I said, but what about me? What about my feeling? I mean, I just don't feel it. I don't feel like I'm in love anymore. I don't feel it. I wanted to have sex with another one. I wanted this. I wanted that. I wanted more. Whatever it was I had, it wasn't enough. I had the Camaro. I wanted the Cadillac. I had the brunette. I wanted the blonde. I had the little boy. I wanted this. I wanted that. What is it? You know, yeah, it would hurt her feelings. It'd be a terrible thing. I might feel guilty. But what about me? What about my feeling? What about my feelings? What about my life? What about me? I made a mistake. I was young. So I told her I wanted a divorce. You know, I told her I wanted a divorce. I had to leave after 5 years. Leave her and the kid. Close your mouth. Okay. Because what about me? No, I'm serious. What about me? It's my life. It's me. I'll pay you child support. What are you crying for? What are you upset for? I said, you know, it's not, you know, people get divorced all the time. I'm just leaving. I'm leaving you. I'm leaving the son. I'm leaving my house. What about me? What about my life? I wasn't drinking when I made that decision. I wish I could say I hurt all these people in my life because of alcohol. I wish I could say alcohol did it. I'm really a nice guy. I'm not really a nice guy. I'm a selfish, self-centered bastard. That's what I am. And if you're an alcoholic, that's what you are. Most of the decisions I made in my life where I hurt people, I made cold stone sober. And the only reason I drank is so I could live with my sorry ass while I was doing it. I wish I could say it was alcohol. Alcohol made me do it. Alcohol didn't make me do it. I did it because I was selfish. Apparently, the guys who wrote the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous agree with me. Because what they say right here... They say, right, apparently, I mean, I don't know. It says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Troubles are inside of us. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self, 100 forms. That means if you've nailed like 20 of them that you know of and you're trying to get rid of, you got like 80 to go you don't even know about. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based upon self, what about me, which later places us in a position to be hurt. So we think our troubles are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcohol is an extreme example of self-overrun riot, though he usually doesn't think so. So guess what? Most of the stuff that's wrong with you, you're not even thinking about it. You don't even know about it yet. In about 30 years, you'll figure out like 2 or 3 things. You'll get a little bit better. And there also seems no way of getting entirely rid of ourself without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore. galore. Moral and philosophical convictions. You know, in Chapter of the Gnostic, they said if a mere set of morals or a better philosophy of life would occur, as we do it a long time ago. You know, you ever hear people say good orderly direction? If you're using that, that's fine, use it. But you want to know what the bottom line is? Good orderly direction is a moral philosophy of life. It's like, do the next right thing. I'm going to be good this time. You know, I'll never do that again. It's you know something? If a better philosophy of life or trying to be a good person worked for me, you know, the bottom line is I wouldn't be here. It never worked for me. The power wasn't there. That's our dilemma. The dilemma is I don't have the power. No matter how much I want to be a good person, no matter how much I want to do it, somehow, some way, in the end, I always steal the money and never give it back. Somehow, in the end, I hurt somebody and I just don't apologize because I don't have the power to do that because I'm selfish and self-centered. It says, what does it say? It says, it talks about people in this book. It says the power of people, the wrongdoings of others, fancied or real or imagined, the imaginary stuff have the power to kill. Selfishness and self-centeredness, how am I going to get rid of it? I mean, I can stop the drinking. How are you going to stop the thinking? You know what the big book says? You know what our program says? It says God makes that possible. It says God makes that possible. It says often it seems no way of getting rid of them without his help. That's why the whole book is about God. That's why it says you can't manage your own life. It's not about managing. Listen, believe me, for 32 years I managed the planet Earth in my mind. Sometimes I had to yell at them. Sometimes I had to scream at them. Sometimes I had to feel sorry for myself and give them the silent treatment. Sometimes I had to hang up the phone. Sometimes I had to do a lot of things to people just to keep them in line and manage the world and get what I wanted. You know, but there's so many of them out there. And they're so full of crap. And they do whatever they want to do, and they don't listen to me. If they would only allow me to be their king and do what I did, but it's like it's almost like they want to do what they want to do. You know? And the bottom line is it's so hard to run the world and get them to understand that you're smarter and better than everybody. And if they only did what you said, everything would be okay. So it says I can't manage the world. You know something? You know what I ultimately realized? That 95% of the stuff that I thought about was absolutely none of my business. So I cut out 95% of the stuff I worried about. You know how I did that? By trusting in God. I could never do it by trying to figure out how to do it. And then you know what I found out? Of the 5% that was left, it would still drive me crazy. And I figured, and this is what I figured out, I said 4% of that 5% did have to do with me, but I had no power over it. And so here I am as left with a crappy 1%, but it ain't that bad because I can handle 1%. And I'm trying to get rid of as much as I can of that because, you know, I've discovered a real interesting fact. You can live quite well in this world without thinking. You'd be surprised. You would be, listen, I'm a thinker. I graduated Departmental Honors in Mathematics. I was going for my doctorate in algebraic topology. I graduated law school. You know, I'm not a shabby thinker. You understand what I'm saying? I'm a thinker. So I thought I had to think, because you have to control. Because when you're scared that something's going to happen to you, you got to control everything. You got to control people. You got to know what's going to happen. You got to know what's going to happen in the future because it's scary. And the bottom line is the more you think, the worse it gets. And you wake up in the morning thinking about that thing, and an hour later you think about that thing, and 3 hours later you think about that thing, and you go to sleep thinking about the thing, and you wake up thinking about that thing, and you say to yourself, I got to stop thinking about this thing, because even you realize thinking about it ain't making it better, and you say, I got to stop thinking about it. You tell your friends about it, and they say, why are you thinking that way? Stop thinking about it. And you say, I know I have to think about it. And then you find somebody else to talk to who won't tell you to stop thinking about it, and you find as many people as you can to start talking about the thing that you're going to talk about, and then you go to an AA meeting, because you figure you'll get better if you can talk more about it, and all you're doing is getting sicker, and you figure, how am I going to get rid of that? And maybe you get a sponsor. He says, why don't you pray over it? Pray over it? That's kind of stupid. I should think about it more. Because I'm addicted to my thinking. And it's like an amazing thing when you get to a point in your life and you realize that the world runs perfectly okay and all sorts of great things happen and you don't have to do anything except stop thinking. Man, if I knew that you didn't have to think in order to do well in this world, I would have stopped thinking before I bought that Camaro. I'd be rich. You know, whenever I tell somebody, they come up to me with a problem. What do you call somebody who has nothing but problems, no workable solution, but knows everything? I refer to them as sponsees. They come up to me with some unbelievable problem. I guess they come up to me because they think I can give them the solution. I give them the solution, and they say, yeah, but you know what I think? And I said, man, that's it. It's gone. It's over. It's over. It's the end of that deal. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. How do you play God? I just told you. You stop thinking. You stop listening. You submit yourself to another human being, and you do what he tells you to do, even if you think they're stupid. You stop thinking. It's a good start. It's a good start because a good sponsor is going to tell you to lay it all before God. He's going to tell you to read things about God. So the first thing about how to stop playing God and how you stop playing God is you give up control, you let somebody else have control. I mean, I know you guys have done a really good job up to this point, but really, you know. Next, we decided here and after in this drama of life, life of God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone. This is the keystone of the new and triumphant arch to which we pass to freedom. This is the main thing. You don't get this, you don't get nothing. All you get is mere sobriety. I want to spend about 10 minutes on that deal, on emotional sobriety. Bill Wilson was talking about the next frontier, emotional sobriety. He said the real problem with alcoholics is that we have unhealthy dependencies. You know, in my world, we call it idolatry. Ten Commandments says it's one of the major sins. Looking to something outside of God that'll solve your problems. Worshiping other things. I don't care what it is. It could be your penis, you know, it could be sex. It could be clothes. It could be vanity. It could be a car. It could be your job. Spend your time. You know what they said in the big book when they said this thing? You know that line they say in the big book? We have found much of heaven and we've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence of which we had not even dreamed. They wrote that in 1939. Now listen to me. They wrote that in 1939. That's what happened. That was their experience in 1939. Most people in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you ask them how they're doing, they'll say, hanging in there. One flipping day at a time. One more day. Hanging in there. Tough, but hanging in there. You know? That's not their experience. Hey, listen, you got to do some desert time in this deal. You got to go through the trials. But these guys said they found much of heaven. They've been rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence, of which they had not even dreamed. The great fact is just this and nothing less, which quite frankly means the great fact is just this and nothing less, not less than this. That we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized the whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today. You know what the central fact of your life is? I'm going to tell you what it is. You want to know what it is? It's what you think about. It's what you think about. The central fact of their lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves. The central fact of their lives was focusing totally and 100% on God. The man and woman you'll be today will depend upon the people and places, the people you hang out with, and the books you read. And the books you read will depend upon who you hang out with. This book was written in 1939. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I may go about 5 minutes over, but I'm going to tell you something you haven't heard before. It's going to change your life or not. Because I think it's important, and people don't understand it. Have you ever heard anybody say at an AA meeting, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path? Let me tell you a little secret. Let me tell you a different way of looking at this. What that means in plain English language is if you do what we did, you'll get what we got. So you're going to read a lot of stuff in this book about things they got. And you're going to look at your life and you're going to say, I don't have that. And you're going to say, why don't I have that? I've been doing this for 10 years. I've been doing this for 5 years. I've been doing this for 20 years, and I'm still a thumb-sucking crybaby. I still go through ups and downs and fears and all sorts of stuff going on. Why don't I have that? And you're going to start thinking that there's something wrong. You know, and certainly we go through times where they're like desert times, but, you know, it sometimes seems like it's so elusive. You know, there's every once in a while you run into somebody. I ran into people. You know, it says if you want, we have, and you're willing to go to any length together, and you're ready to take certain steps. I've run into those people. They'd be part of my we, and I wonder what they have. One day I went to a meeting. I'll make a long story real short. There was a guy at the meeting, had about 30 years. His name was Al Kennedy. He stood there. He did the meeting. He spoke to the people about his life and who he was and what he was. I was amazingly lifted up. He had a just very positive, wonderful message, and he helped. He just opened up my mind to a lot of things. He walked out the door. You know, I'm used to discussion meetings where, you know, well, let me tell you about my problem. Well, let me tell you what my mother said. Let me tell you what's happening at work, you know. And it was just unbelievable. He was wearing life like a loose guy. He was like genuine. He was authentic. You know what I mean? There was no playing around. This was him. This was who he was. He was okay with himself. You know, one of these guys that you sit there and say, man, I wish I could hang out with that guy. You know, you ever been with somebody, maybe it's your sponsor or somebody, that no matter how screwed up you are, when you're hanging out with them, you talk to them, you walk away and you feel better.
Yeah.
You walk away from the person, you just feel better. You hunt down these people because you walk away from them no matter what's going on. They say, and they don't even have to say a lot. They may say two things. It's going to be okay. Don't worry about it. And you walk away because you believe them, because you feel better. There's just something about them. They have gravitas. They have something that you feel better. And he was one of those guys. And I had about 3 or 4 months when I saw him talk. And he walked out of the room. I told my sponsor, I said, that guy was great. And he says, you know, he's dying. That's exactly what he said to me. He said, he's dying. And like, I didn't even hear him. I said, no, I'm talking about the guy who just did the meeting. He says, yeah, he's dying. I said, what do you mean he's dying? He says, he just did the meeting. He says, yeah, he's dying of cancer. He's got 3 months to live. You know, I'm sitting there. Now, you imagine what I'm thinking. You know, I'm about cars and women. And how am I going to pay the mortgage? And, you know, I think I got a hangnail. And, you know, blah, 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 yeah. You know? He's saying, I said, what do you mean? He says, Ross, he's got cancer. I said, but he didn't say anything about it. You know, what about me? I mean, I'd tell you about it, you know. I'd at the very least say, well, you know, it's good to be here. I have cancer, but it's okay. I would have let you know, just to get something from it, you know. But you know what happened? What happened when I Al Kennedy became one of my, part of my, because I was there. I saw this. And I've seen other guys like Al Kennedy. I saw it in front of me. A guy who was unafraid, and he was dying. I was afraid of everything. Everything. And I saw a man who was dying who was unafraid. And I said, man, how do you... And I didn't know how to do that. Do you know how to do that? I don't know how to do that. And one day they told me I was going to... I could die. I had to go in for an operation. They said, I may not come out. And I was there with my sponsor, and he was praying over me with some other guys from the church, and I was unafraid. I said, it's okay either way. And I was 25 years sober. I said, it don't matter. It's cool. I'm cool with it either way. Because I wanted what he had. He became part of my week. Because my vision of what A was about was not merely staying sober. It was to have emotional sobriety. It was to get with... I wanted the Al Kennedy sobriety. I didn't want to have the... I didn't want to have the not drinking club variety of sobriety that most people settle for in here and applaud for. I wanted to have that rocket in the fourth dimension of sobriety. You know, experiencing much of heaven sobriety. Not having the fear of people and places and other things and economic insecurity. I wanted to have that deal. I didn't know how to get it, but I knew it was available. Because they told me it was available in the book and I saw that it was available. So let me tell you what the final deal is on this. Let me explain something to you. AA was started in 1935. You get it? Does everybody know that? It started in 1935. Bill Wilson met Dr. Bob in 1935. It was an outgrowth from something called the Oxford Movement. Bill Wilson had a couple of sponsors. They were clergymen. Sam Shoemaker, and he was Episcopal priest, and Ed Dowling, who was a Jesuit priest. And Bob Smith, it was him and Bob Smith, and they also had Clarence Snyder and a few other guys, you know, there. And they worked the AA, what we would call the AA program, the program of recovery, for 4 years straight. And they experienced unbelievable things happening in their life. So they got together a committee, and they put this book together. A committee of alcoholics. And after the committee, you know, like it's a law. You ever see what a committee puts in? Now, I love the book. I'm a student of the book. It's a great text. But what people don't understand, and, you know, things were taken out and things were put in, and some stuff was put out and some stuff was taken in. But this isn't necessarily the program that some of the Al Kennedys were totally working. You want to see what they were working is, you got to read this book called Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Understand, when they wrote that sentence in 1939, you do what we did, you'll get what we want. Rarely have we seen a person fail as thoroughly followed our path. Their path was not about reading this book. You understand that, don't you? Because it hadn't been published. Their path was a path of what they were doing the 4 years prior to writing this book. Now, I'm not going to tell you what they were doing, or what, well, you know what books they're reading. Because if you read this book, you'll find that the books they found absolutely essential was 1 Corinthians 13, the book of James, we almost called the James Club, and Sermon on the Mount, which is Matthew 5, 6, and 7. That's where it all came from. Let me just tell you a little bit about AA. When they say, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Let me give you an example. Let me read you something from this book. It's a long book. It tells you all the stuff they were doing. So obviously I'm not going to go into everything, but I just want to tell you what they were doing. You see, because when you see here, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It's like a recipe. You do this, you want this chocolate cake, follow this recipe. If you say, man, I love this chocolate cake, you follow the recipe. If somehow you say, I love this chocolate cake, but I'm not going to use cream, I'm going to use skim milk. I'm not going to use sugar, I'm going to use saccharin. You'll get something, but it ain't going to be that chocolate cake. You know, you're going to change it somehow. So let me read you something from page 101 of Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. Okay? On the other hand, this is what they did before you went to an AA meeting back then. This is how AA was conducted in the first 4 years of Alcoholics Anonymous. On the other hand, we were taking them upstairs and getting them on their knees to surrender, which I felt was a very important part. The surrender was more than important, it was a must. Bob E., who came to AA in February, did you hear that? It was a must. They wouldn't let you in the meetings unless you got on your knees and surrendered to God. Didn't have much qualm about the third step at that point, huh? Bobby, who came into AA in February of 1937, recalled that after 5 or 6 days in the hospital, when you had indicated that you were serious, they told you to get down on your knees by the bed and say a prayer to God, admitting that you were powerless over alcohol and that your life was unmanageable. Furthermore, you had to state that you believed in a higher power who would return you to sanity. There you can see the beginning of the 12 steps. He said, we called that the surrender. They demanded it. You couldn't go to a meeting until you did it. If by accident you didn't make it in the hospital, you had to make it in the upstairs bedroom of the Williamson's house. Dorothy S.M. recalled the 1937 meetings when the men would all disappear upstairs and all of us women would be nervous and worried about what was going on. After about a half an hour or so, down would come the new man, shaking, white, serious, and grim. And all the people who were already in AA would come trooping down after him. They were pretty reluctant to talk about what had happened, but after a while they would tell us they had a real surrender. I often wonder how many people that come in now would survive an experience like that, a regular old-fashioned prayer meeting. That was alcohol. You see, when you hear, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, you think that their path was what you're doing today and what you're hearing today in Alcoholics Anonymous. You need to read this book. It had nothing to do with what's going on today. Because you know, the whole program is run by alcoholics. Thank God we have this book. Who knows what it would be if it wasn't for this book. And alcoholics want people to like them. And more than anything else, we rationalize. We tell ourselves rationalize. And the last thing we want is, God forbid, somebody should leave here thinking badly of us. We want people walking out here and says, you know, I just went to AA. Man, that guy Russell, he's so nice. He made me, oh, I love him. They're so nice. We don't want people saying, oh, they talk about God or the Bible. We don't. That people might think we're uncool. So, you know, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. We'd rather see him die, you see, than insist upon the surrender. So what we do is this. This is what, you ever see this happen in a room? You know what our form of surrender is now? We don't have them get down on your knees. I'm not saying you should get down on your knees. We have our little forms of surrender. Like, we do this. This is a form of surrender. This is how I surrendered. You say, anybody want a white chip for desire to stop drinking? You ever see this happen in a meeting?
No.
That's a form of surrender. What it does is, because everything in here is about humiliation. It's about getting humble. Now, I don't know anything about being humble. I really don't. I can't wake up in the morning and say, well, I think I'll be humble today. It's impossible. I'm like arrogant. You know, you can tell just by looking. I'm an arrogant guy. But I know I'm arrogant, okay? You know why you guys are here tonight? You know why how you came to AA? Because you were humiliated. That's how we threw 100 forms of humiliation, the final question of our self-sufficiency. That's how we knew that. You're in AA, not because you want to be AA. You were in AA because somehow something happened in your life where you were humiliated. Then you come in here, and they pick up a white chip. And you know what you're forced to do? You're forced to stand up. I was forced to stand up in front of a bunch of people. I'm a trial attorney, National Science Foundation fellow, and walk to the front of the room and pick up this chip in front of everybody. It's almost like I'm saying, like I'm new and I need help. What's that crap all about? I ain't never going to do it. You know what? But I was scared and I was desperate and I wanted it. You know, people think willing to go to any length is like you got to climb the highest mountain. How about walking up and picking up a white chip? And you want to know something? We don't even want people to do that. How many times have you been to a room, and I'll tell you what they do sometimes in Dade County, I don't know about Broward, they'll say, well, if you're shy, I'll just put it over here, and you come up after me so nobody can see you, and you can sort of sneak up and take it. Because we don't want to hurt your feelings. Why don't you just buy him a drink? Just buy him a drink. And we think that's the program. We think that's what they were doing. They were getting them on their knees. We're at least sewing a white chip, and we don't want to do that. Ah, don't worry, just keep coming back. And then, you know, you got the third step, getting down your knees. That's humiliating. The fourth step, writing down all your stuff, you know, so you can talk. That's humiliating. The fifth step, telling somebody, that's a form of humiliation, in a sense. Going, even picking out a sponsor, saying to somebody, will you help me? And then telling, that's humiliating, in a sense. The sixth step, turning your life over to God completely and trying to grow in the image and likeness of His Creator, of your Creator, and then humbly getting down. That's humiliating. The eighth and ninth step, going out to other people, then you're scared of them and saying, I was wrong, I'm at fault, here's the money back, or whatever it is. That's humiliating. All the, even getting up here, even doing service and saying, talk to people and doing the talk, going up to people doing is sort of like in a form of humiliation, because you're thinking to yourself, maybe they'll laugh at me, you know, maybe I'll screw up. But you know something? You pocket your pride, you humble yourself, it's sort of humiliating. You go out there and you say it, it's humiliating. That's why Dr. Peebo said ego, deflation, and depth. And I drank to get away from feeling humiliated. I felt humiliated in less than all my life. And I drank. And this is telling me this is the stuff I have to go through to get right size and be okay. Because when I'm weak, He's strong. I got to get weak in order to allow Him in there to run my life and listen to other people. Everything in me works against this program, tells me not to do this thing. And that's what they were doing back then. You got to read this thing. I mean, there's a lot I haven't read. You got to read what they were doing and what they were reading and what they were doing and the kind of meetings they had and what they were for. Of course people like this would write stuff like that. There is one who has all power. That one is God. What would you expect them to write? Of course when you go to He Sold Himself Short, you would hear one of these guys say something. This is, you know, Bill Dotson, the man on the bed. Said, I knew there was something more, something I hadn't got. I was trying to find the answer. He went up to Bill Wilson, he finally listened to Bill Wilson, said, the Lord's been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease, that I could keep talking about it, telling other people. He said, that's it, it's all about God. It's all about God. And some gal from North Carolina says, can you tone it down a little? Some gal calls me from North Carolina, she says she's an AA. We want you to talk, but can you tone it down a little, because you talk too much about God. Why don't I just become one of the people that rip this program apart and kill other people? Because you know what they discovered? This is what they discovered in the 1940s and 50s. They discovered, and you'll like this, that an alcoholic could stop drinking and stay physically sober and didn't have to do all this stuff. Did you hear what I just said? They discovered that an alcoholic could stop drinking and stay sober and did not have to do all the steps the way they did it. And by the way, Alcoholics Anonymous is made up of alcoholics. And alcoholics are selfish, they're self-centered, they're devious, you know, they're manipulative, they're rationalizers, and they try to get out of stuff. And when alcoholics discovered that people would clap to them at the meetings, all they had to do was not drink, and they like the fellowship, it's almost like going to the bar after all, and they could somehow stay sober, not drink, because that's what it's all about. What do you think alcoholics started doing? They started doing a different type of program of recovery. Let's call it Alcoholics Anonymous Lite. And you know what? Some of them stayed sober for 5 years, some of them stayed sober for 10 years, some for 20. A lot of them drank again. But you know, they didn't get what these guys got. They didn't get the rocket ship in the fourth dimension of existence, of which they had not even dreamed. They didn't get that deal. I'm going to end by reading this. This is a story in the book. They sold themselves short from one of those guys that did it the way they used to do it. These last 18 years have been the happiest of my life, tried though that statement may seem. 15 of those years I would not have enjoyed had I continued drinking. Doctors told me before I stopped I had only 3 years at the outside to live. This latest part of my life has had a purpose, not in great things accomplished, but in daily living. Courage to face each day has replaced the fears and uncertainties of earlier years. Acceptance of things as they are has replaced the old impatient chomping at the bit to conquer the world. I have stopped tilting at windmills and instead have tried to accomplish the little daily tasks, unimportant in themselves, but tasks that are an integral part of living fully. Where derision, contempt, and pity were once shown me, I now enjoy the respect of many people. Where once I had casual acquaintances, all of whom were fair-weather friends, I now have a host of friends who accept me for what I am, and over my AA years, I've made many real, honest, sincere friendships that I'll always cherish. I'm rated as a modestly successful man. My stock of material goods isn't great. Don't have a lot of money. But I have a fortune. Here's his fortune. I have a fortune in friendships, courage, self-assurance, and an honest appraisal of my own abilities. Above all, what would you think this guy from the 1940s, the guy was brought up during the first year, what do you think he'd say? Above all, the great fact is this and nothing less. Above all, I have gained the greatest thing accorded to any man. What do you think would be the greatest thing in this guy? What do you think would be the central fact in his life? What do you think? The love and understanding of a gracious God who has lifted me from the alcoholic scrap heap to a position of trust, where I've been able to reap the rich rewards that come from showing a little love for others and from serving them as I can. I wonder what he would have said if they got the call from North Carolina saying, maybe you can tone it down a little. Maybe you can tone it down a little. You know, it's your life. You can do it. It's your life. You can do this thing any way you want. You can spend 20 years in this thing, putting a buck in the pot, you know what I mean, and get the mere sobriety thing, you know, and, you know, join the fellowship of the thumb-sucking crybabies. Or you can join the fellowship of the Spirit. They talk about it in the last page. They say you'll see some of us in the fellowship of the Spirit. That fellowship, by the way, is populated around the sixth step, which separates out the men from the boys. Trust me, there is a separation. Whether you like to hear it or not, there is a separation that happens between the men and the boys. And many are called and few are chosen. And you better believe there's a separation. It's biblical. It's scriptural. It's in our book. It says this is the step that separates the men from the boys, which means there must be some men in here, and there's probably a whole lot of boys. And fortunately or unfortunately, we all meet in the same room. So you get to pick whether you want the Al Kennedy type of sobriety or you want that hanging in there stuff. Hanging in there, one more flipping day at a time. Plug in the jug. Deal. God bless you. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to ask the volunteer to come up and do the chips.